I don't know about the parabolic side of things. I think something that could trigger that would be to give us context for, I'll just use rich dad, poor dad, for example. You know, basically you take leverage and you buy assets. Bitcoin, it's not exhibiting that type of energy. This is just not a parabolic.
What's up, guys? 70,000 of you guys keep coming back every single month, but 71% are not subscribed. So you're going to miss out on some of the great green candle content. So make sure that you're hitting that subscribe button with the bell notification so you get notified every time I drop a video. All right, now let's get back into this great interview. Bing bong. We are back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Nick Bhatia in the house, the author of Layered Money and the CEO, founder, the director, everything involved with the Bitcoin layer. So Nick, I've heard you on a few podcasts here recently about the disruption of the four-year cycle. Now, we have a lot of liquidity coming into the market potentially tomorrow as we're recording this on the 16th. And it looks like the Fed is going to cut interest rates by at least 25 basis points tomorrow, potentially 50. So with this and the amount of liquidity that we see starting to dump into the Bitcoin market, how do you see the cycles and where are we going from here?
The liquidity cycle, let's separate the liquidity cycle and Bitcoin's past cycles for a second. So from a pure Bitcoin perspective, Bitcoin has experienced parabolic price movements in 2013, 2017, 2021. That cycle, we should expect another parabolic move in 2025 based off of these four-year halvings and all of that. At the moment, we are not seeing it. We haven't seen evidence of it building up this entire year. We haven't seen it. And for that reason, I believe that the previous hold that the halving cycles have had on Bitcoin's price are probably starting to decline. It's a little bold to say that they've ended. And I don't necessarily think that they've ended, but the statistics show us that the two previous bull markets, 17 and 21, that 25 has materially underpaced those two prior bull markets. So that's not something, that's just the statistics there. And I do believe the market, which is saying, hey, we don't think that the post-halving extreme bull followed by deep bear is the way that this one is going to go. And I believe the market for what it's saying. Then let's go over to liquidity, which can be influenced higher by lower rates, like you referenced, for sure. But liquidity is also a measure of what are the conditions in the market for credit creation. Sometimes when rate cuts are coming, it's because there's a disaster in the economy and they need to slash rates to basically save things. That's not what's happening right now. There is a return to more of a normal interest rates, which they're hoping is going to stoke more borrowing. For example, a mini wave of refinancing of homes that were, you know, taken out at a 7 to 8% mortgage rate over the last few years. Well, we can get mortgage rates down to 6 or even 5. You're going to get a huge refi wave and that will get consumer spending going. So you're correct in that the rate cuts can stoke that borrowing and get things going, and that's what they're hoping. But I don't think that there's going to be a ton of liquidity just from these baby rate cuts. It really comes from the entire economy getting used to the fact that inflation is not really going back to 2%. It's probably staying closer to 3 and higher, and that's a new fundamental. The market understanding that the economy can do well with inflation at 3% and policy rates at 3.5%, for example, that the economy can not only survive but thrive in that environment. That creates economic growth, which creates income, which creates disposable income, which people use to buy Bitcoin in part. And so a strong economy for the US is bullish for Bitcoin too. So I wanted to just separate those two issues here because we're really talking about the macro economy and Bitcoin's own fundamentals. And there's crossovers, of course, but wanted to separate that to begin with.
Yeah, 100%. Now, you mentioned a few interesting points here because I think we've gotten kind of some disillusion in the overall market and the economy. So I'm curious kind of just how you view it, because on one side, we've got the S&P 500, gold, all of these assets hitting all-time high, Bitcoin just under the all-time high right now. And then, you know, on the other side of things, we have, you know, if you look at the Google search trends, reaching for help with mortgage right now, just surpassed 2008's Google search trends. Then we've also got, you know, housing kind of being in a shaky spot where we're seeing things that are worse or, you know, just as bad as 2008. And then we have, you know, on the job side of things, like a million jobs being revised right now. So, you know, Trump is yelling at Jerome Powell, calling him too late or too slow Powell, basically referring to all of that. So I'm curious how you view the overall market right now and the economy as it stands here today.
Yes, there are segments of the economy that are not doing great. For example, pockets of the labor market, like you suggested. There are pockets of borrowers that are not doing well. On the aggregate, though, the measures of economic growth are robust, and a big part of the US economy are these mega tech companies, and the amount of profit that they're generating feeds back into asset prices. It feeds back into just the support of economies. And especially in states like California, heavy engineering economies, there are aspects of the labor market that are very weak. And the Fed is actually responding and cutting rates to say, hey, we recognize that hiring is slowing, that unemployment is on the rise, that jobs have been basically faked for the last couple years, and that we're removing those. So the employment picture isn't as rosy, but the economy is judged by policymakers off of one metric, and that's GDP, and that's real GDP growth, which is a growth in excess of the inflation rate. So right now, the nominal GDP of the United States is running 6 to 7%. When you have debt growth the size that, or you have debt the size that the US has, and growth of that debt at the rate at which it's growing, an economy growing at 7% nominal GDP is the only way the United States can survive. So that's how they are looking at it. And I understand that corners of the economy that are not doing well, especially borrowers on the margin that are facing difficulty, like you said, those people aren't seeing the same economy as the, you know, the mega seven tech companies or anybody associated with the right pocket of fiscal deficit spending, which, you know, consider a lot of the defense, healthcare industries. These are industries that are heavily supported by that fiscal deficit. The hiring in healthcare outpaces the rest of the economy, in large part just because of that sustenance that the US government provides. So a wise person on the desk once told me, everybody's inflation rate is different. And a good way to expand that is that everybody experiences a different inflation rate. Everybody experiences a different economy, because of their skill set. And because of that, everybody experiences a different labor market. And so the US economy is fundamentally changing in a lot of ways. We don't have to get into all the ways that AI and robotics are changing the labor force to know that things are shifting in that way. The US economy is less and less manufacturing based. Policymakers hope that there's a revival of that so that we can diversify away from the over-reliance on services that we might have at the moment. But yes, everybody is experiencing a different labor market. On the aggregate though, 6-7% nominal GDP growth.
Yeah, so it seems like the narrative is like we can grow our way out of this debt with AI and everything else. So in your opinion, do you think, you know, we're going to be able to do that? Or is this kind of the start of the crash of the dollar and moving towards a Bitcoinized world?
Okay, so I'm going to start with the crash of the dollar first. I think that the dollar versus other fiat currencies can go a lot lower over the coming years because it's actually been too expensive over the previous couple decades. And that's been a policy decision that's perhaps and maybe for the better of the United States being reversed as we speak. That decline of the dollar versus other fiat currencies can lead to a stronger US economy versus the rest of the world, which can lengthen the runway of the dollar system. So it's a little bit of a paradox in that a weakening of the dollar versus other fiat actually extends the runway of the dollar system by maybe decades. And really sustains the system if the dollar isn't too expensive versus other fiat currencies. The dollar versus real assets will continue to decline because it's being diluted all the time. That is very empirical and observable to anybody looking at trailing performance of real estate, equities, gold, and to a less extent, Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is a relatively new asset class and a way to express all of this. But if you look at longer time series, it's important to see that the dollar's devaluation versus real assets is multi-decade fold in the works. Bitcoin's rise, then I'll go to your last part, which is Bitcoin's rise is a network effect that is locked in and technological in nature. So in my opinion, very likely to follow the path of reaching 5+ billion people over the course of decades, just as the internet and smartphone, cell phone usage, social media as well. The penetration of these technologies to the globe reaches significantly more than 50%. After certain amount of years. I think Bitcoin is on that path. So Bitcoin's rise is honestly, it's more network growth driven than anything if we want to look really far into the future. That yes, it shall continue and that there is a relationship between price and the age of Bitcoin. And so as it continues to mature, and grow in its network, that the price should rise over that time horizon. The existence of this shakeup of the global monetary system through the dollar, you know, getting too strong, debt growing too big because of that, or alongside that, and then the US dollar needing to weaken so that the US government can grow its nominal GDP to get its way out. And that dilutes the dollar and feeds back into real assets. All of that supports the network growth of Bitcoin.
What if I told you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Instead, you can borrow against it with Salt Lending. Why give up your hard-earned Bitcoin when you can unlock its value without letting it go? With Salt, you get secure Bitcoin collateralized loans with no credit checks, no prepayment fees, and best of all, no rehypothecation. Salt has had zero customer collateral losses since it launched. Salt was the first platform to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans starting way back in 2016. Today, they offer tailored options for both individuals and businesses. And now introducing Salt Shield, the no liquidation solution. No forced liquidations during the lifetime of your loan when you're enrolled with Salt Shield. This just launched at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, and it is next level peace of mind. For Green Candle listeners only, head to saltlending.com/green-candle for this exclusive offer for your Bitcoin collateralized loan. You can get cash for your Bitcoin today. Salt Lending, secure, trusted, proven.
All of that supports the network growth of Bitcoin as well, of course. So now let me answer your question about debt to GDP for the US. I'm one of the more optimistic people out there, at least that I hear on how the US can manage, even though its current indebted levels appear to be very high relative to its GDP, which is true. It's not that debt is low, and $1 trillion in annual interest payments is material for sure, because you have to borrow so much money just to pay back the interest itself before you get to any of the services that you provide to the public. But the asset side waiting to be monetized for the United States is possibly in the hundreds of trillions. And that is a combination of not only the land assets, which I'm not suggesting that the federal government go and sell Yellowstone National Park and homestead it again, or anything of that nature, but natural resources, both in the ground, mineral energy resources that haven't been built yet. So for example, future nuclear power plants, but also the intellectual capital and the innovative spirit of the citizenry, which is all basically untapped wealth and assets of the US government, in that they have access to a tax base. And even in a low tax environment, if the asset base of the United States grows in its measurability, capacity, productivity, that these are all ways that the nominal GDP of the United States can grow, it will, I believe, also be dependent in large part by continued deficit spending, but more of the right kind and less of the wrong kind. So there is a path to more sustainable debt to GDP. There's a path to a better measuring of the assets to debt, which is a more appropriate ratio, debt to assets of the United States, because right now, how do you really measure the assets of the country? It's difficult, and there are studies on it that range from the 100 trillion to hundreds of trillions of range, but that range is so large that it makes that exercise very difficult to do. So it's a long way to say that I'm very bullish on the country and its ability to sustain itself. If the bond market eventually does put that penalty on the borrower to say, hey, you better fix your situation or change what you're doing, then the government won't act. And perhaps over the last few years, some of that dynamic has made its way into the Treasury Department, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and maybe it hasn't. I'm not making some big claim there. And the yield curve honestly has been quite flat and hasn't really gone very steep. It means that there's not really a penalty on the US government for borrowing for 30 years, which is flabbergasting to some that think about how much debt that the country actually has relative to its GDP. The reason that penalty isn't there, I believe, is due to a lot of the reasons that I've outlined about the potential of the US economy.
Now, I'm curious. You mentioned the potential of the U.S. economy. Now, there's been a lot of chatter here, of course, of, you know, the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve, Bitcoin kind of helping out as, you know, potentially helping out the dollar's rise. So I'm curious what you view on, you know, the connection between the two. And do you think, you know, you mentioned Bitcoin's price as well. Obviously, Bitcoin's increased in price value with like a $2.5 trillion market cap right now as it stands. So when we're getting an increased, you know, market cap and everything else, even though there's increasing demand and it seems like there's not a lot of sellers out there, at least right now, you know, with the amount of demand we're seeing from treasury companies, potentially from governments, and then retail on top of all of that, will Bitcoin, you know, somewhat change the viewpoint of, I guess, comparatively to traditional assets because it is the only truly fixed supply asset that there is?
I think that assets in general are always in a relative discovery from the public. So they're shifting between different assets all the time. But the most consistent theme is that credit isn't wealth. Credit doesn't equal wealth. Assets and collateral is wealth. So what is the US doing by trying to introduce pro-Bitcoin policies? It's trying to attract collateral to the country. Bring collateral here. And even raise the value of that collateral so that credit can flow through. Credit issuance needs collateral, good collateral. Now, think about it like this also. The fiscal deficits and spending and trying to invest in the country, the US has to do it for the future. So the policies that it has to introduce are technology forward policies. For example, chip manufacturing. Let's just start with chips, okay? Because the chips lead to AI data centers, which if we have the data centers here and the chips are made here, then we're more vertically integrated as a technology provider. But let's just start with the chips, which are currently made only in Taiwan, the ones that we need. We can't build what they build over there. We need to be able to build them here. So does it matter what the government spends for them? Does it matter what they spend, or is it more important to get the technology? So they'll spend anything, basically. They'll devalue the dollar to whatever extent they need for the technology. And I want to credit also Kane McGuckin, who came on my show this earlier this month, and we discussed this issue together, and he connected these dots for me because I've been talking about this build out, that the build out of AI data centers and the build out of chip manufacturing as important to the country. But if you connect the dots, that actually the devaluing of the dollar versus real assets, you can phrase it as the devaluing of the dollar versus technology capabilities. So why wouldn't you make that trade-off as a country? Bitcoin is part of that technology stack, the new technology-based economy, which is digital. And Bitcoin out of nowhere, basically, out of nowhere, has jumped into the ring in its strategic importance for the United States, as opposed to its first 15 years of existence, which was basically anti-bank money, anti-fiat, protection against the crash of credit assets versus real assets. Because I still didn't think the dollar was on some death spiral 3 years ago, and I don't think it's on some death spiral today versus or just in terms of it being the credit system of the global economy. I don't think we're going to a Bitcoin-based global economy or a Bitcoin collateralized credit-based economy anytime soon. That's a more of a multi-decade vision, but I don't think that that's something that we're up against for the US.
Now, I've got to, you know, you've been talking about the dollar potentially losing some value here against other fiat currencies. And you think that, you know, we're not necessarily to a place of hyper Bitcoinization, but if the dollar loses that reserve status, this bull run, I think everybody should focus on getting their Bitcoin in self-custody and off exchanges. We all saw what happened last time with the huge blow-offs. We had Celsius, FTX, all of the big dogs blowing up. Well, this time everybody's being smart and holding their Bitcoin in self-custody. This is why I'm going with the number one hardware wallet in the game. That's Trezor. You can go to trezor.io or the affiliate link below to get yours for 5% off using promo code GreenCandle5. Get your Bitcoin off exchanges in the easiest way possible. They are a trusted brand. They've been in the game the longest of any hardware wallets out there. So that's why I've partnered with them, making it the easiest for you to get your Bitcoin off exchanges and not have to worry about any counterparty risk. So do it today. Go to the affiliate link below. Use promo code GreenCandle5. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show. But if the dollar loses that reserve status, you know, what is realistic, do you think, to replace it? Do you think we're going to have, you know, multiple fiat currencies? Is there going to be, you know, a potential of this gold or Bitcoin backed dollar or using multiple assets, sort of what RFK Jr. was running on once upon a time? Or, you know, is there going to be some sort of a different transition prior to getting to that hyper Bitcoinized world?
So a quick calculation in my head right now says that the increase in gold's market cap over the past, call it year or somewhere around there, has been somewhere in the tune of several trillion dollars. I would probably call it somewhere in the 5.357 trillion range. And I wish I had the number for you right now. But just think of that. $5 trillion of additional global reserve asset minted in the last year just by the increase in the gold price in dollar terms. So it is US policy to get other countries to have a less reliance on their own debt for the world reserve asset in being treasuries. But that doesn't mean that they want to stop seeing the dollar being used for credit issuance, because that is a benefit. That benefit accrues back to the country's borrowing rate. Because if everybody around the world is lending and borrowing in dollars, that means that investors hold a portfolio of dollar-based debt assets. And when they seek safety or some anchor of their portfolio, they buy US treasuries. So a strong dollar credit issuance system reinforces treasuries as an asset class. The US is happy to let gold and Bitcoin slowly step into the role that US treasuries played exclusively for the last few decades. They are also well aware that China has already been doing this for a long time. So they're preparing for this. At the margin, there might be some penalties, such as 5% 30-year rates, which is where they were for much of 2025. They've come down a bit since then, but they were up there. But the US doesn't need to issue more 30s, and they haven't. They're issuing more bills. And what is it doing? Is it blowing up the bill market or blowing up the treasury market? No, rates have been coming down. So again, there's no penalty, Brandon, out there that the market is saying, hey, your borrowing is too high. It's the market does not say that. In fact, the 10-year treasury yield at 4% today is below the Fed funds rate today. It's below the repo rate today. And even after they cut 25 basis points, the 10-year yield will still be below the overnight yield. That means that to the naked eye, there is no reward to lending the government money for 10 years if you're an investor. And you would think that if the US government wasn't in a great financial position, that the market would be able to demand maybe 50 basis points more, 1% or 2% more than the overnight rate to lock your money up for 10 years. But it's zero. And that is the signal that a rates analyst must take to the description of what's going on.
Now, it seems like the U.S. Treasury market is showing some serious dysfunction from what you're laying out. So what are kind of the systematic risks from that? And, you know, is this, I guess, the collapse of the U.S. empire almost, you know, accelerating because of what we're seeing going on in the bond market? Or am I just, I guess, reading the situation a little too extreme?
No, it's not dysfunction at all. It's actually a scarcity of collateral. So it's the opposite of dysfunction. It's actually the market saying we need more treasuries. We're starved of them. And yes, from 2021 to 2023, there were periods where it looked like the US empire was collapsing as far as how quickly yields were rising. But it really was just a broad dumping of fixed income assets in the middle of the greatest inflation wave of the last 40 years, both statistically and, you know, also historically. What we saw post-pandemic inflation was unprecedented. And there's no doubt we're still in the echo of that. Like the price increases that we are still experiencing every day. Some of it is due to spot differences in tariffs and import prices. But most of it is still in the echoes of this inflation wave due to supply chain reorientation and you know, complete disruption of the economy through shutdowns. And then, you know, a break in some of the reliability on certain Chinese imports and a diversification of supply chain. So for all of those reasons, we had a near catastrophe in the bond market in 2021, 2022. But since then, it has smoothed. And this year, all of a sudden, you are seeing the renewal of a lot of strength in the bond market.
Now, okay, so we're seeing some strength in the bond market, but you might, referring back to what you said a little bit earlier with that inflation target moving potentially to that 3% range, you know, with the dollar kind of at the base here, and it seems like it's, you know, it's lost 95% of its purchasing power in the past 100 years, and then 40% since the year 2000. You know, do you think that's just going to accelerate and the strength of the dollar, not only to like other fiat currencies, but is just going to essentially collapse with all of this? Because it seems like that kind of layering you know, you described so eloquently, it seems like, you know, it's not like the dollar dominance is going away just oh so slightly, but that might not be a huge issue in your thesis. Is that correct?
Well, the devaluation of the dollar, like you mentioned, lost 95% of its value versus real assets. That is a gradual process. That's the process of the frog getting boiled but not noticing. That will continue, Brandon. That is a fixture of our society. It is why, you know, if we go back to, you know, I'll just use Rich Dad, Poor Dad, for example. Mm-hmm. Those types of lessons that you teach, financial lessons, which is you know, basically you take leverage and you buy assets and you make sure that your assets yield more than you're borrowing. That is our capitalist society. Mm-hmm. And credit, especially now that it's fiat, credit doesn't have any limit in issuance. And then when they go over the limit in terms of finding defaults, when they actually start finding the defaults, the government comes in and saves anything, because a collapse in credit issuance is the nail in the coffin. Not only for the banks, but the governments too. Like, the governments will get voted out if everything falls, right? If the banks fall, the banks all go bankrupt, but then, you know, the economy collapses and people lose their jobs, and then the government will get fired too. So it's in all the power structure's best interest to keep it going. So the banks run the credit system. When the banks issue too much credit, they get bailed out by the central banks. The central banks are quasi-government institutions anyway. Everything gets legislated. The politicians vote for it all, sign it, and it's the merry-go-round that never stops. So let's not, you know, lose sight of that important fundamental, which is that the dollar versus real assets will continue to decline. And maybe wages will keep pace with asset prices. Maybe they will continue to undershoot asset prices. Maybe they will continue to undershoot home prices, which they have for the last 50 years. You could buy a house with 2.5 times your income in the 70s, but now it takes 5 times your income. That's devastating for the purchasing power. Like you said, purchasing power just dwindling and dwindling. So that isn't stopped by these policies that I'm, suggesting that the U.S. government do to continue, you know, sustainability and its credit system and the ability to borrow.
Why would you ever hold generational wealth on a piece of paper? It doesn't make sense. You need a foolproof solution, and I've got it for you. You could get this as low as $25, and if you use promo code GreenCandle, you could get 10% off. Being around for 12 years, they've engineered the perfect and most easy to use solution. I've partnered with CryptoSteel to offer for you guys just that. It is the cheapest and most secure way to store your seed phrase. I don't know about you guys, but I don't have too many things where I think one ton is going to fall on this, but it could survive all of that and more. So go to CryptoSteel.com. You can use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order if you go there today. So go ahead and protect your generational wealth and do it with CryptoSteel. All right, enough from me. Back to the show. Now, where do you think the role of CBDCs and stablecoins plays in this? Because we've had a lot of chatter around that recently. And, you know, it is kind of interesting, the connection of Tether to the United States government, especially with now Bo Hines going from, you know, the crypto house, so to speak, in order to go to the private sector now with Tether. And then, you know, it seems like Tether, instead of using USDT, now is like creating like USA Tether, which is kind of a unique wrinkle that I don't think a lot of people are talking about as well, which essentially hints at that USDT was not up to the US regulations previously. So they had to make a full another stable coin for that. But how do you see this kind of playing into the thesis as well?
Yeah, a lot of the USDT has gone through Chinese money laundry at some point. So it's not really touchable from the US onshore regulatory system. That would be the reason why you suggest you're citing that. The stablecoin thing is a big deal. And let's talk about CBDC first, which is that You had a anti-CBDC movement over the past few years from USA-based Bitcoiners. And while we got some anti or some CBDC ban type of legislation at the state level, then some executive orders along that line, even though you got some of that ban language out there, what was more important to the never CBDC future was the Stablecoin Act. So now there is no reason to get a CBDC going, because now you've officially sponsored the private market for digital dollars. So if the Fed ever has one, it's really probably going to be more just like a technological solution for reserve management with the banks, but we don't really have to go there. The key is that U.S. citizens, I will say, U.S. citizens will not be using a CBDC anytime soon. And that is a direct result of the way that the government went towards stablecoin legislation. So that's pretty important. Rest of the world, it's a dice roll depending on where you are. There are some countries that it's extremely likely their citizens will be forced into using CBDCs at some point. So let's just focus on the US. The stablecoin movement is part of that technology stack that we talked about, allowing the US dollar to be used in all sorts of situations around the world for reserve management that translates directly into US Treasury ownership. The euro dollar system is a big target here, because the euro dollar system has euro dollar based assets, dollar denominated offshore assets that are basically receiving a lower borrowing rate than they otherwise would have, because there is no suitable way to store euro dollars. Stablecoins provide that alternative to a lot of offshore dollar system usage and assets, which, if you want to bring geopolitics into this, which benefits directly the Belt and Road Initiative, which is denominated in dollars in most of the capital market activity. The lending and the build out of Chinese infrastructure all around the world is being done with the euro dollar system. So the US wants to challenge that. Every policy it's rolling out can be related to China, even though you don't really hear it much. The euro dollar system is back to Dr. Stephen Miron's speech, which he made a few days after Liberation Day in April of this year. He said that the dual public good must end, that the US provides the world, which is defense for free and the ability to use the dollar system as they see fit for free. And so every decision that you see the US making is going to be addressing these two issues: either make them pay for defense or get them to stop devaluing their currency against the dollar, meaning let the dollar devalue. And alongside that, what you're doing is you're preventing these countries from using the dollar as a credit system as freely as they once did. So stablecoin, it's like, well, you're preventing us from doing this and you don't want us to hold treasuries and all that. Well, okay, there's this new stablecoin system that will be well collateralized, will accrue to us as a US borrower, because it at the margin cheapens our borrowing rates, because there's more demand for our debt through the system. And it tries to claw back some of that offshore dollar usage to accrue to the US. So the stablecoin strategy is very big picture. I think it's a coffin for a US-based CBDC, which is a good thing. It's very free market and deregulatory oriented. But the deregulation, I would say the lack of regulation abroad for dollar usage, meaning that global banks using the dollar to their own advantage around the world, is something that the US wants to challenge but didn't really know how. And this is one of the ways in which it truly can start to challenge, I believe.
Now, how does this relate to, or I'm curious your opinion of what Russia kind of came out and said about the U.S. potentially using the dollar or the crypto and Bitcoin industries to essentially pay off all of our debt and manipulating the markets in that sense. Do you think that the U.S. is doing that and Russia's essentially just shedding some light on that, or do you think like you kind of described the stablecoin initiative is almost to kind of combat the Chinese CBDC movement?
It's an adversarial way to put what they're doing. So I won't dismiss that they're saying it or even that from their point of view, it's inaccurate. So
this bull run, I'm looking for ways to stack Bitcoin in my sleep, and mining has always caught my eye. I've partnered with the guys over at Simple Mining to help you do just that. I don't recommend anything that I don't use personally, so I've got a machine up and running with them right this second. And they've even opened the facility up so anyone can go and visit. They manage over 15,000 machines for 500 clients, handling all of the maintenance and repairs so you don't have to. And for the Green Candle listeners, they're giving an exclusive offer, all the repairs for the first year for free. So if you've been thinking about mining, head on over to simplemining.io/greencandle to get this exclusive offer and learn about the potential tax benefits that you can get from mining with Simple Mining. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
From their point of view, it's inaccurate. So that's one way of saying it's their right to call it out as they see it, and I'm not going to argue with how they see it. I see it through the lens of an American, and I'm thinking about how do we sustain our country for the next 100 years. So that's how I'm thinking, and for how they frame it, the same way, Brandon, that I'm framing the Belt and Road Initiative, capitalizing on the dollar system to get their infrastructure routes, set throughout the whole world. Belt and Road, as in the Silk Road, right? The ancient trade routes that connected Asia to Europe. And China's trying to build that out for themselves. So should I call China out for trying to strengthen their trade network or influence in their part of the world, that they're just going to do it? As in an adversarial way, I could say that, they're doing this and that, but that's not my position. But I wouldn't dismiss an adversary from saying what it might about what the US dollar is doing. The US is acting in its best interest. Full stop.
Yeah, and I mean, as they should, but I think the kind of the connection here between all of this industry and the way it's moving is very interesting, especially with, the way Trump is going at it. Now, I want to bring it back to more of the overall macro economy. I know you were saying some pockets are potentially, pretty weak, but some are actually doing pretty well. Now, with the cutting of the interest rates and where Trump wants to take it, which is essentially the zero interest rate environment. Look, I know Powell is in power right now, but Come around May, I'm sure Trump will appoint somebody that wants zero interest rates. Now, with the 3% inflation that we're already seeing, does that get worse? In your opinion, do you think that the inflation is essentially here to stay and potentially never going away and increasing rapidly? Or is this just, I guess, the only solution to strengthen the sectors of the economy that are poor right now?
So the idea that the Fed has any control over anything is a myth. The market is what sets interest rates. So until the two-year yield crashes below 1%, I don't believe that rates are going to zero, policy rates are going. If they were, the Treasury market would be pricing it in. So I don't think that just because it's some Trump appointee that they can get away with cutting rates far below where the market suggests that they should be. The market tells the Fed where the time value of money is at all points in the curve. So over what time horizon does the market expect rates to be here, here, and here? The market doesn't expect rates below 3% in any part of the curve on the policy side. Or otherwise, parts of the curve would be below 3%. So there's nothing to suggest that the next Fed chair will cut rates that dramatically. The 3% versus 2% inflation target is important because if the next Fed chair starts cutting rates 4, 3.5, 3, 2.5, let's say we get to 2.5, and then inflation starts picking up, the yield curve will steepen, rates will go up to 4-5%, and the Fed will have to respond to the fact that inflation is coming back into the market. The inflation expectation is back, and they'll have to stop cutting rates because they've stoked it too much. And so the Fed is just a lagging, the economy is the cart and the Fed is the dead guy, you know, tied to the cart that's being dragged on the ground. That's the policy rate. Now it does affect arbitrage. So I don't mean to dismiss like the policy rate and the front end of the curve as an anchor, but that it's just following where the market says the time value of money is at any time. That's why the Treasury market changes on a second-to-second basis when we get inflation readings, economic readings, unemployment readings, geopolitical news, and the policy rate changes once every 8 weeks, if that. Right? The policy rate is not dynamic. The market tells you where rates are going. So to summarize, rates are not being cut to zero. There's no expectation of that, and I don't believe they're going there. As rates do get cut, inflation might come back, as you suggested. And if and when it does, the Fed will have to stop cutting rates at a certain point because the market has already said, hey, time value of money is more now, and we're selling bonds. Rates are going to go up, and we're punishing the inflation reading, basically. We don't want to own treasuries at 4%. We're going to sell and wait till they get to 5%. We'll buy them there, but until they get there, we're not buying. And why would they buy? Okay, the Fed is saying, okay, I'm ready to get inflation back under control. I'm going to stop cutting rates. So the market always leads.
Now, what is this going to do for the Bitcoin price action? I mean, we talked about it briefly, that it's going to be, you know, positive in the future, but, you know, we have been doing kind of this slow tick up, and you described it earlier about, you know, that we would expect some sort of parabolic rise. Are those over? If so, where do you think we're going? Or do we have another parabolic rise and it's just going to be next year or, you know, potentially sometime in the future?
I don't know about the parabolic side of things. I think something that could trigger that would be like a massive bailout, a bank bailout, that type of thing, money printing wave, could trigger something like that. So I won't dismiss that, but it's not something that I see in the near future. What I will say though, Brandon, is that what our work that we do at the Bitcoin layer is driven by what moves the Bitcoin price. That's what we're trying to discover in the macro sense. What we discovered is that it's not lower rates that causes Bitcoin to go up. What causes, and this is more of a short to medium term phenomenon, but what causes Bitcoin to go up? Not treasury yields falling, but treasury volatility falling. And what that means is a stable financial system, a worry-free financial system. So if rates are gradually going down because things are okay and the Fed wants to, you know, calm the market, then that's probably going to be a good situation for Bitcoin. But if the Fed is cutting rates because the economy is doing poorly and risk is coming back into the system, volatility is coming back into the system, that's probably going to be bad for the Bitcoin price. So it's not really just rates coming down. It's more, like we said, what's the economy doing and how is the financial system doing? And more specifically in the financial system, how's the ability of borrowers to roll their debt? That's the key. Can they roll their debt? If they can, all good. If they can't, crisis. It's like very binary in the way that we observe financial markets over the last 15 years. It's like good until it's not. For now, volatility is very calm. That suggests a supportive situation for Bitcoin. But we've had calm volatility all year, for a lot of the year, but no parabolic moves in Bitcoin price. I think it's maturity of the market. I love a long consolidation of the Bitcoin price. You know, I'm in the minority. I don't like to see the pumps last, because when the pumps last, too much unrealized profit comes into the market. People sell, and then people panic sell. Then you get winters. I'd much rather see this cyclicality slow or die. And again, it's not easy to try to predict something until you observe. So that's why we lead with independent research. And I thank God that I'm not the hedge fund manager.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely seems like that is, it's very interesting how you're lining this out. But you know, how much weight do you put into, I guess, the behavior of the investor with Bitcoin here, especially when we have everything, it seems like I said, it's like all quiet on the Western front. If you look at, you know, Google search trends for whatever, take that for what it is, because everybody sees the rise and, you know, using AI to search and everything else. But, you know, we do see massive amounts of these treasury companies come on. You know, if you look at Bitcoin on exchanges, it's been at 2.25 million for a little bit. But the amount on OTC desk is limited. Is there that potential? You know, like you said, even though you say there needs to be some sort of, I guess, black swan type of event or bailout or something like that. Is there a potential to see, you know, some more of this parabolic rise without something like that, just because there's more attention and notice towards Bitcoin, which would mean more dollars kind of flowing in? Or is it, just pretty, I guess, par for the course, what we're seeing as this asset is developing over time.
All right, Brandon, you got me taking the chart out. So
let's do it. You can share the screen if you'd like to.
No, it's all right. I've just, I just described the candles to you because, it's all nothing right. Complicated, but I'll pose a question to you first. Would you argue that 2025 behaviorally has been one of the most bullish years in the history of Bitcoin? Policy, treasury companies.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. I would agree with you that from a news cycle perspective, even the amount of Bitcoin that Strategy has purchased on just by itself, that this has been one of the most bullish years in the Bitcoin news cycle in all of Bitcoin's history. Yet, Bitcoin got to 123,000 in July and has traded basically down over the last three-ish months. So I'd like to keep it really simple that, yes, at the point at which it had reached 123,000 and it spiked back up there, we got even one more new all-time high, that when the Bitcoin price, when it got the opportunity to run away in the middle of this year, it didn't, because selling came in, because there was some unrealized profit. We saw these whales, old whales, liquidate. We heard stories. There's probably coins that moved from here and there that we didn't see. There was enough selling to knock the price back. So when we got the opportunity, we didn't see it. And the consolidation that we've had, listen, October might come and the price runs up, we get the parabolic move, and the last 56 minutes is, you can clown me on it. So it's, but I'm not smarter than the market. That's my point here. I'm not smarter than the market, but I can read a chart. And the chart says that over the summer, you got the vibes that, hey, can we pump this thing? Can we get it going? And you've traded flat since July. And honestly, you can go all the way back to December 2024. So now we're talking about 9-10 months. And it was at 108 there. You're at you're 8% higher versus that high mark post election and pre-New Year. So that's calm. That's not parabolic. And then, you compare it to 21 and 17, like we talked about, it's just materially underpaced. So that's enough for me to say the market behavior is speaking to you. It's not getting overheated, because it hasn't. And that should be the going theme as a trader, as someone who's looking at ranges and all that. And I say trader meaning that's how I approach a market as a trader. I don't actually trade these markets. I write about them, and I love writing and charting. And the readers want me to give them my independent thoughts as without the position. Because if I was talking my book, that would be different, but I'm not talking my book. People know that I have a Bitcoin dominant investment thesis going back 9 years. So they don't have to be confused with who I am or what my position is, but I can still say, hey, I don't see the price running away from us right now, because the chart doesn't say it. So I wanted to just bring in those levels of like 108 and 123 going back 2 months and 9 months to give us context for the fact that this is just not a parabolic. It's not exhibiting that type of energy. And I think that that's pretty bullish longer term. It means that maybe the returns can get more smoothed out instead of seeing years that experience 70. I think a 75% decline in Bitcoin's price is only achievable after such parabolic moves. So maybe it's wise that we want to avoid them. But again, I won't speak for the market. We'll let the market speak. And my price target continues to be around 139. But I don't have a great time horizon on that, because the market just seems to be grinding sideways.
There we go, man. I love it. Well, you've been very generous with your time, so I appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge. Why don't you tell people where they can find out more about you and the Bitcoin Layer?
Yeah, thebitcoinlayer.com. Everything that we're doing is over there. My books, our channel, our podcast, and of course, our fantastic research newsletter, which goes out to all of our TBL Pro subscribers. Everything is available at thebitcoinlayer.com.
I'll put all that in the show notes. And Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them, and I'll see you guys all at the next one.